for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new Pentagon report on the Afghanistan insurgency said the Taliban is getting stronger. Pakistan has shifted 100,000 troops from its border with India to focus on fighting militants along the Afghanistan border. Hundreds of people rioted in eastern Afghanistan after a NATO raid caused the death of an Afghan lawmaker's relative, and the Greek debt crisis sparks concerns throughout Europe. Joining me in the studio to talk about the top international stories on this week's Friday News Roundup, Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet. Join us on Facebook. Good morning to all
of you.
Good
morning. Good morning.
Greece, has it decided yet to make the necessary cuts? And where will those cuts be in order to avoid this crisis?
Greece is eager to get on and try to get out of the crisis, and they know that what's coming their way is going to be hard and politically destabilizing. This weekend, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is going to announce a major package for Greece that includes money to bail out, but includes conditions that, for example, very important wage cuts in the public sector, very stringent limits on their spending. And it's not clear that this is going to do the job. This has been more a story about Europe and the inability of Europe to deal with a crisis within countries that have adopted the euro as their currency. And so, and the larger story even than Europe is and Greece is Spain, because the markets and the financial markets are now very doubtful that Spain can remain stable, and Spain is a far larger country, far bigger economy, and its collapse can then unleash a major instability in Europe.
Daniel Dombey, Greek labor unions are not reacting very happily toward the news that they are going to have to take wage cuts.
Yeah, this is a very dramatic situation in Greece. Also, the retirement age will be going up more than 10 years.
But To the 60s,
yeah, exactly. But Moises is entirely right. The question is this enough? The answer is almost certainly not. The Europeans have taken forever to agree on this. They wanted to take ownership of this because they themselves say this is not about Greece, this is about the euro. But they've had awful problems. The French for a long time didn't want to involve the IMF, largely it seems because Nicolas Sarkozy sees Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the head of that organisation, as a potential presidential rival. The Germans desperately wanted to delay this until after a regional election in May. It's not, as a colleague of mine wrote in a brilliant column this week, it's no way to organise a bailout.
Well,
it might be good for the Congress of Vienna, but it's not good for the 21st century.
But as Moises pointed out, Spain is next in line and could be even worse off than Greece. The question is this a test of how well the European Union can work together?
Absolutely. And I think what Daniel got at was exactly point on, in that how much domestic internal politics within Europe is shaping how the greater European community responds to economic crises like this. We saw this in Germany and again, as Daniel mentioned, in France. And so this certainly is a test. And so far, it shows that the Union, European Union, is not qualified to sort of handle this on its own and has had to turn to things like the IMF and other organizations to help it along. I think it raises questions about how much the union collectively can take on its own.
And commentators are connecting the slow, inefficient, ineffective reaction of the European authorities to the financial situation to the same ineffective way in which they reacted to the airline problems as a result of the volcano eruption that disrupted airlines throughout Europe and the world, indeed. They were slow, they were not coordinated, and so this is just a story about a government, a federal government in Europe that really doesn't work that that way. It's not a federal, it's still a collection of entities. So at the end, when we're going to look down back on this, we're going to decide, this either unleashes more Europe or less Europe. The result of this is going to be more united, more coordinated Europe, or a deeply fragmented Europe where essentially Germany and France go their way and the rest of the countries have a deep instability.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting this morning that Greece could come to a final agreement as early as this weekend, Daniel.
It depends what you mean by final, though, doesn't it, really? Because no one thinks that this is going to be enough to sort out Greece long term. You've seen the yield on Greek debts really move about this week because people think that Greece is eventually going to default. It has something, you know, well and above, I think, of $200 billion in debt. It has a not very productive economy. It doesn't export an awful lot. It's not easy to switch that over. And the problem, the fundamental problem here is the fundamental problem of the euro, which is normally if you have these kind of problems, you devalue your currency, you lower your interest rates. Greece doesn't have those options to hand. The only thing it has is swinging budget changes. And to be honest, people simply don't think it can do those enough to pay the money it owes at the time it owes.
Daniel Dombia, the Financial Times, to join us. 800-433-8850. Nancy Youssef, the Pentagon, gave Congress an assessment of the insurgency in Afghanistan with some sobering news.
It was a sobering report indeed. This report was required by Congress, an assessment on the situation in Afghanistan, and it outlined a lot of troubling developments. It said that the Taliban was stronger, the Afghan government's support among urban areas was weaker, violence was up, IED attacks against troops are up. So it was a collection of sobering news. I personally think that the Pentagon purposely put out this report the way it did to sort of set realistic expectations for what to get out of Afghanistan. And I think the other thing to note in that report is that it really raised questions about the Afghan security forces and whether the United States could get enough going and train them properly. You know, this report really said Afghanistan is not Iraq, that these forces cannot be trained in the same way that they were in Iraq. In Iraq, the soldiers tend to be more educated. There was more infrastructure. There was a stronger government to support them. And all of that is missing in Afghanistan.
And in Afghanistan, the people are rioting.
That's right. They're in Nangarhar province, which is just east of Kabul, a female parliament member. A male relative in a neighboring house was killed. These forces come in during a night raid, which the Afghans really hate. Came in during a night raid. Soldiers show up in a very, I think, normal reaction, some would argue, and certainly in an Afghan reaction. This man came out with a gun to protect his home. He was ordered to put his weapon down. He didn't. He was fatally shot. And it led to an outpouring on the streets in Afghanistan from people who are saying, I don't just fear the Taliban now. I fear the Americans, too.
So where does this leave General McChrystal and his view for Afghanistan, Moises?
I think Nancy is right when she says that this is a sobering call to just keep your expectations down and don't expect that this is going to be solved or resolved easily. The report says that in 92 of 121 provinces in Afghanistan, the population is sympathetic and supportive of the Taliban. And that means, you know, one needs to interpret that very carefully because in some instances it may not be essentially a support for the Taliban's ideology, but it may be just a reaction to foreigners that come in and destroy your crops, that they're coming into your homes at night and they are seeing
so
more as an invasion.
Basically anti-American.
Right. Or NATO in general. But there is a very strong, it's very difficult to parse out what of this is affinity and support for the Taliban ideology from a strong nationalistic reaction to essentially economic motivations. And again, remember that a lot of this has to do with the way in which most of the farmers in Afghanistan make a living, which is the growing of poppies that eventually become opium and heroin. And so the eradication and the fight against all those things also needs to be factored into the kind of attitudes that we are seeing there.
Daniel.
Well, I think this is the most admirable thing about this report is exactly what Nancy said, which is it looks honest and it is important to have a clear view. And some of the figures are terrifying in this report. It says that, you know, the whole push is for the Afghans to start replacing the Americans, as we remember, in July next year, which is not a long way away. And yet it says that over half the trainers that should be there aren't there. And the training effort is financed by the US. I think the US spent something like $6.6 billion this year on training. The Afghans, $140 million. It shows how fragile an enterprise this is, how it's not supported, really, by the conditions on the ground. And if you look at it, and the fact that not a single province of 128 provinces, which are identified as key, supports the Afghan government, it shows how big the problem is. That said, there are some very Afghan results. 80% of the population thinks that over 80% of the population thinks there's corruption in their daily lives, and yet over 50% thinks the government's going in the right direction. These are people who have different expectations from us, and the situation may be desperate, but it may not be impossible.
Nancy.
I took two conclusions away from the report. One, I think the U.S. has to be careful about getting in the way of any sort of reconciliation effort, given how stressed its effort is there. And two, I think it really raises questions about how realistic it is for the United States to expect to train Afghans in a Western-style military or police force. The report suggests that their efforts right now are floundering.
Nancy Youssef, she's with McClatchy Newspapers. Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times. Moises Naim, editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. Here's our first email on Afghanistan. It's from Carm in Falls Church, who says, why is the U.S. not winning? One nasty fact totally ignored here is the brutality of U.S. forces in and out of uniform in their behavior toward the Pashtun. Even now, troops are told they're in Afghanistan to avenge 9/11. Recall that the Pashtun defeated the Red Army, what NATO could not do in 40 years. They fight back. Nancy.
You know, I think what's really happening, I think we talk about this as a military problem, but the thing that's undermining this effort more than anything is the political problem. You know, counterinsurgency depends on having a reliable partner among the population, a reliable government. And the United States is not clear on who its partner is on the Afghan side. On one hand, we sort of say we're supporting Hamid Karzai. We sometimes undermine him publicly. And at the same time, the United States is trying to build up these local governments, recognizing that Afghanistan is not designed to be run by a strong central government. It's geographically, it's in every sense meant to be run on a much more provincial, local level. And until that's resolved, until that political issue is resolved, nothing else in my mind can really fall into place. Our strategy now is to train the Afghan forces so that they can take over. And yet, we're not clear on who these Afghan forces are going to answer to. Who's their boss? Who do they answer to when the U.S. military leaves?
All right, let's talk about why Pakistan has shifted troops to the Afghanistan border, Moises.
The Pakistani government, the Pakistani army, was always reluctant to take on the North Waziristan region, and also they have an obsession, a long-standing obsession with India. The militaries in Pakistan were trained for many years to expect a major conflict with India. And so they didn't want to distract from that. And now they are discovering that inevitably they will have to go and deal with that area in Waziristan, from which there is a lot of activity that irradiates to other regions, and they're being hit very, very strongly. The Pakistani army has had three times more casualties since 2001 than the American and NATO forces. There are more Pakistani soldiers. 2,700 have been killed since then.
Daniel.
Yeah, I'd just like to put maybe a slightly different gloss on that. This figure was in the same report that we talked about, the Afghanistan report, and it's actually a historic figure. It maps not what's happened in the last couple of days or weeks, but actually what happened really across 2009. What happened in 2009 was after a very public wobble, which led the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, to say that Pakistan had abdicated in its fight against the Taliban, they then moved into a couple of regions, Swat in particular, which is not so far away from Islamabad, but in particular, a big push in South Waziristan. This is where the Pakistani Taliban is, and it's very important to be clear about this. This is where the people who have been attacking the Pakistani government, who actually murdered the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, the wife of the now President Zardari, those people are based in South Waziristan. They're not the people who are fighting in Afghanistan. And what's happened, actually, is that over that time, the Pakistanis have taken on what they regard as an internal threat. Now, in terms of al-Qaeda and the people who are fighting in Afghanistan, they're not so convinced. We're hearing some noises about they might go into North Waziristan. We've heard some noises in the past that they're not really rushing to do so. The argument that very senior military officials made when they came to Washington just a few weeks ago is we're actually at full stretch right now. We're in South Waziristan, we're in Swat, we can't move. And there's still a big question mark about those areas, because just as the case in Afghanistan is the US can win a campaign, but it can't really get a foothold in terms of transferring power, the Pakistanis are having the same problem.
And what about these new reports that the Pakistani Taliban leader, Massoud, is alive? What's the significance, Nancy?
Well, we heard earlier this week from intelligence agencies that despite reports in January that Massoud had been killed, he was wounded in the airstrike but is still alive. And so the significance, I think, it is a couple. I think it just raises questions when we claim, you know, the United States has had a habitual problem of claiming that top leaders are killed and then they end up being alive
Crippled. Yes, exactly.
And remember when this happened, the Taliban refused to say that he was dead, wouldn't confirm those reports. Even the Pakistanis were hesitant. The only thing that I think diminishes this as a story is his role has been quite diminished as of late, and so his significance right now is in question. But I think it really raises questions about how the U.S. goes about affirming who's been killed and who's still alive in these airstrikes.
So how much can the U.S. rely on Pakistani intelligence?
And that's the central message, I think, of this. Let's also remember that initially we were told that Hakimullah Massoud had died in a duel when he had a fight over who was in charge of his faction. And that proved not to be true. Then we were told he was killed in a drone attack, and now it's not. So that, as Nancy said, essentially points to how thin and unreliable is intelligence. But it also complements another report that we saw today about the splintering and the fragmentation of all the groups and the Taliban and different insurgencies inside Pakistan. that makes it very hard to understand who's who and who is now allied with whom. They are just a rearrangement of coalitions. And also there is a long-standing issue with the alliance that elements in the Pakistan intelligence service and the army have with Mullah Omar, which is an Afghan Taliban. He's the head of a very important larger faction of the Taliban from Afghanistan, but living in Pakistan, who they regard as their important tool for whatever happens in Afghanistan after Americans leave. The story, the way in which many Pakistani leaders say, you know, the Americans may be here today but gone tomorrow, and we are then left with an insurgency and a failed country to deal with. Mm. And Mullah Omar and the Taliban may be our allies when this happens.
And one last question. India's and Pakistan's prime ministers have met for the first time in months. How much progress there?
Well, they said it was a very positive meeting, but it's a tiny baby step when you have intractable problems. The fundamental problem here is that these are two countries that are deeply suspicious of each other. Pakistan regards India as an existential threat. India regards Pakistan as a source of terrorism. They are both deeply suspicious of each other. That makes any solution of the problem in Afghanistan much harder. But I'd like to, if I may, also just to go back to the earlier point about Massoud, because there are two really important things, I think, about Massoud. One is just remember this guy, how important this guy is. This is the guy that the CIA blames for its worst disaster in 25 years when 8 of its agents were killed in Khost at the end of last year. So it's very personal. It's very high profile. The second is this is how the war on terror is carried out these days. There's a lot of talk about reaching out to the Muslim world, but actually what this administration does is fire missiles from drones and then ask the Pakistanis whether they hit or not.
Which raises the entire issue about the U.S. government ordering assassinations. There is an ongoing debate about, you know, should the U.S. government decide on killing leaders in other countries? And so for some people, the obvious answer is yes. For others, is a democracy like this should not do that. And then the drones, very often, that's exactly what they do day in and day out. They identify leaders that are...
But quite often kill innocent civilians as well.
And you know, that's a larger debate about drones. And people will tell you that they have been quite effective in thinning the leadership of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
All right, let's talk about the UK elections, Daniel. How did the candidates do in their third and final debate last night?
The consensus of every single poll was that David Cameron, the Conservative leader, who's looking to bring the Conservatives back to power after 13 years, won. The question is whether he did enough to get the Conservatives an absolute majority, because it's an unprecedented situation in Britain. You have a fight between three parties in even terms, in a way that we haven't seen perhaps even since the 1920s. That means the result is very volatile. Any one of a number of results could occur. I personally think that Cameron probably has done enough to get really at least one foot into 10 Downing Street. He seemed much more relaxed than Gordon Brown, who had a disastrous gaffe in the debate itself. And the novelty of Nick Clegg, the Liberal Democrat leader, seemed to be weakening. This is an incredibly important election in Britain for two reasons. First of all, it could spell oblivion for the Labour Party if it has a bad result. It's every poll, almost every poll, has put Labour third, which would be the first time it's been third since 1910. Almost every poll said that the last 2 weeks. It could lose, if it had a bad result, anything up to 70% of its seats. So it's a real possible meltdown for Labour if it does quite badly. On the other hand, we could see the first coalition government really exactly. Since the Second World War.
Nancy.
Well, it's funny. This week we were talking about the 65-year-old woman as part of this elections and a gaffe that Gordon Brown had. He was speaking with her and she expressed her concern about immigrants from Eastern Europe, and he had a Sky News microphone on and called her a bigot, and suddenly this raised questions about his temper, about the scorn and rudeness he showed towards voters. And
he went to apologize.
He did.
To her personally.
That's right. He tried a phone call and that didn't work. They tried statements publicly. That didn't work. And finally he went and saw this poor widow shaken visibly by all of this, and it suddenly exposed the frailty, if you will, of the Labour Party in a very quick way. It was quite a blunder.
Moises.
Michael Kingsley, who is the editor, a former editor of the New Republican and Slate, used to say, he once wrote that a gaffe for a politician is when he says in public what he thinks in private. And so in this case, Cameron again said what he thought. This woman was...
Brown.
Brown, I'm sorry. Brown said that. And in fact, if you heard what she said, you know, it was not unreasonable to have the thought cross your mind that she, in fact, was bigoted. And she was, you know, she was saying very strident, horrible things about immigrants and the rest. The story about the election in the UK, where the consensus is that Cameron is going to win and he will have enough of a majority to form a government, is that the challenge is not to form a government, but to govern. Because Britain is going to have to undertake reforms as painful and as deep as Greece.
Like what?
Like cuts in public services, like cuts in public spending.
If Conservatives win,
no,
or
if whoever,
no matter who
in order,
wins.
Yeah, that's and one of the stories is that perhaps the British public has not been well prepared by the debates in these elections, where none of the candidates was sufficiently clear and sincere about what is going to take to bring back the UK economy to stability.
Moises Naim of the Foreign Policy magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Daniel, I know you want to get in on that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think I'm British, and I'm not so sure that we can always blame the politicians, because if there's something unpleasant, we just try not to think about it. It's part of a British reserve which hasn't done us so well in the last few years. It's absolutely true what Moises said. The Labour government from 1997 to 2007 increased public spending by half. We are now one of the most spendthrift, to be honest, countries in the world as proportion of GDP. And taxes didn't keep up with that. A large part of that was based on the financial sector, which is what we thought was our great ace in the hole. That didn't turn out so well either. We are contemplating the tightest cuts, possibly since the Second World War. It does look a little bit like the House of Cards in Britain. I would say, yes, it's true that none of the three parties have spelt out the $50 billion or so dollars worth of cuts that they're going to have to carry out. On the other hand, the British public just doesn't want to think about it because it's too depressing.
And that's what politicians are for. That is what leaders are for. You would expect leaders to prepare a country. You know, you had a leader that promised blood, sweat and tears at one point, and perhaps this is the economic equivalent of that. I also want to say that this is not just a British problem. The reticence, you know, the European publics have been inured and more or less distracted and not told that what's coming the way on Europe is going to be very, very painful.
Moises, tell me what's happening with the Thai government and its red shirt protests. I'm not sure I understand, and perhaps people need to hear more about that.
It all starts with an election, well, with the ousting. First, it starts with the election of a telecommunications tycoon called Thaksin Shinawatra, who is one of the wealthiest people in Thailand, who got elected and became prime minister. Then there was a whole corruption scandal about with him, and he was ousted, and he's now in exile because if he gets back, he's going to go to jail. Another prime minister, Abhis Vejjajiva, was elected. He's a British-born, Oxford-educated young technocrat that is leading the country. But in the midst of all that, there's a movement called the Red Shirts, funded, which are sympathizers of the former Prime Minister Thaksin, and they wear red shirt. They are very aggressive. They take over airports and they paralyze the city. They take over. They go to parliament, and the government has been in a clash with these red shirted that include young people and old women and children, and they all go and they sit in the main arteries of the city, or they stop airports, and this crisis, which has been unfolding now for a while, has already claimed 27 people.
So is the government in control of the situation or not?
They claim they are, and yet there's a debate going on about whether there needs to be an international intervention to bring down the violence. There's been the military has attempted to intervene. It hasn't been able to calm the situation down. And so, but the government obviously wants to say that it's still in charge and it's got this under control despite all outward appearances otherwise.
Yeah, no.
There's a sense in the last few days that the red shirts have gone too far. They stormed a hospital saying there were soldiers there, which didn't go down too well. This is actually one of those fundamental problems, which is it's, in a certain sense it's a country versus the town. There was an established political order in Thailand with many rural voters feeling they were outside of it, and the army was quite happy with it. Mr. Thaksin was actually, improbably enough, seen as the leader, the hero for these rural voters. The red shirts are these rural voters. But what's happened is that it's such a polarised situation, the old political system can't deal with it anymore.
Daniel Dambia, Financial Times. If you'd like to talk about Thailand, Greece, Great Britain, Afghanistan, Pakistan, do join us, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Aetna Foundation, committed to improving health, wellness, and access to high-quality, affordable care for everyone. Learn more at aetnafoundation.org. This is NPR.
After retiring from his weekly show in 2004, Bill Moyers returned to broadcasting with Bill Moyers Journal on PBS. Now, after 3 years with the Journal and 4 decades in the business, Moyers says he's really retiring from weekly TV. His last show is this week. On the next Fresh Air, we feature excerpts of our interviews with Bill Moyers. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones. We'll go first to William in Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
I have a question specifically about the British National Park.
Sure.
My question.
William, I'm afraid we're not getting you. Can you get on a landline? I'm afraid we can't hear you. Let's go to Parma, Ohio. Good morning, Ralph. You're on the air.
Yes. It's a no-win situation in all of these because it's fighting an enemy that's a civilian, and I don't care what their political reasoning or whatever. You cannot win any kind of insurgency or insurrection.
Interesting. We've got a number of comments on Facebook regarding Iraq, which is likely one of the areas that Ralph is talking about. Pam says, honestly, Iraq will destabilize before we get the last man out, regardless of what's put in place. At some point, we just have to leave. It's just sad. We've left their infrastructure in an almost complete shambles. Nancy.
Pam, in a lot of ways, sounds like the Obama administration. The United States has said it is leaving, even though that looks like it could be weeks or months before a government is formed in Iraq, even though the election appears to have been divisive and that there's real question about whether Nouri al-Maliki, the incumbent, and Ayad al-Alawi, right now the winner, and their coalitions will be able to work together. And I think the question becomes, what could the United States do if it stayed? Remember, the United States is there at the invitation of the Iraqi government. And the movement, the train has sort of left the station. The United States is moving towards training these Iraqi forces, putting them in the lead. And I'm not sure that there's anything more that the United States could do.
What about the election discord? Could that affect the U.S. timetable, Moises?
We are talking about three votes of difference. These were elections for 325-seat parliament, and the Maliki state of law won 89, and the Iraqiya won 91. So they're winners, but they are contesting votes and everything else. So you can take two views about this. You can say, well, that's what happens in imperfect democracies, and we have seen around the world contested democracies where people are clashing, including in Florida. So that will be a flippant way of saying, you know, the elections, that's the nature of democracy. The other more troublesome view, and I think more realistic view, is this is just more of the same, a manifestation of a deadly, lethal clash between Sunnis and Shia. It's there, and it's just a struggle for power, and is now taking that manifestation, but when that is over, they're going to continue to battle each other in other camps. The good news is that so far, this has not been as violent and deadly as it used to be 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, I would agree with a large part of that. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that this shows the fall in U.S. influence. The Obama administration has been very concerned about what Mr. Maliki's done to try and get the lead and the prospect of leading the next government back from Alawi. It's been very concerned about some of these attempts to kind of strike people who have already been elected from Parliament. But those are pleas that aren't backed up by anything very much. And in a certain sense, that's perhaps good, because these are decisions that Iraq has to make. It's not clear how keeping US combat troops would help. In fact, one of the big champions of the surge, Fred Kagan at the AEI, wrote a piece in today's Washington Post where he said it was really in only extraordinary circumstances should the US delay its plans to get its combat troops out by the end of this summer.
Next.
I think that shows this is now Iraq's problem, and it's actually not a bad problem for a Middle East country to have to work out the results of an election.
Nancy.
You know, I thought it was interesting this week that we learned that there was a secret prison in Iraq that largely held Sunni prisoners, where people were tortured, and there are charges that Maliki knew about it. We're starting to see the kind of state that is emerging. It's a quasi-democracy, but that still sort of employs tactics that are reminiscent of Saddam's regime. I mean, who makes a good torturer but someone who's been tortured? And we're starting to see that. What can the U.S. do to stop that? The other thing I want to say is there's a real practical reason why the United States can't leave, and that's because it's committed troops to Afghanistan. That 30,000 that's being sent in Afghanistan is conditioned on U.S. troops leaving Iraq. And in addition, you have a U.S. military that's really already starting to think post-Iraq in terms of how it's going to reset itself, train itself for the next kind of warfare. The military's left Iraq already, and I think the Obama administration has too.
I met a young woman just last night, having served 3 terms of duty in Iraq, headed off to Afghanistan Sunday. Here's an email from Joe, who says most of us would prefer not to pay taxes. Greece seems to have many large problems, but the fact few pay their taxes is one of the biggest, it seems to me. Why isn't the government serious about fixing this problem to get money into their coffers and solve it. Moises.
Yes, Greece not only had a problem of not collecting sufficient taxes, but it also had a problem of cooking it, the books. For a long time, the best guard, you know, the open secret was that you could not rely on Greece's government's statistics. But Greece is collecting more taxes is just one of the problems that Greece will face. Cutting public expenditures and realigning a lot of the state to make it more functional and more efficient is another major challenge.
And here's an email from Frank in Mooresville, North Carolina. He says, Greece has been less than forthcoming in their reporting, so what should the Germans do? It strikes me they are in a bind. If they don't fix Greece, the whole of Europe would suffer. But how are the Germans to know what the true cost would be? Daniel.
Well, there is a debate that is really boiling hot about whether the best thing is for the Germans to allow Greece to default or to allow Greece to push Greece out of the euro and so on. But these are really uncharted territory. There's never been anything like the euro before. How can you turn a euro into drachmas when the euro is what you trade from Finland to Athens? It's incredibly practically very hard. The Germans have this desperate desire for Greece not to default because they feel that a default would show that the euro was a weak currency, it had no confidence in it. And yet people look at these numbers and they simply do not know how Greece can pay what it owes when it owes it.
All right, to Panama City, Florida. Hi there, John. You're on the air.
Thank you. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
My question is twofold. This one is for Moise. And what level of intelligence will it take to find Soari and Bin Laden? Since I know they need medical care, they have to eat. Seems like we can find them. The second question I have is, follow-up on that would be, if in the event that we did actually kill them, is there a subtle nod to the fact that we would martyr them and that would create more problems? So it's almost like a two-edged sword either way we go.
All right, Nancy, you're anxious to respond.
I am, because I'm always fascinated with this question. What happens if Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are killed today? What happens? And it's an interesting one because, you know, the al-Qaeda that attacked the United States, the one that was based in Afghanistan, is far weaker now. It's far weaker. But al-Qaeda, Inc. is stronger. It's expanded. It's now in Somalia. It's in other parts of the region. And so I think people assume, you know, on one hand, you kill the people who perpetrated those attacks. But if they are killed, I wonder if it'll give the Obama administration an out to tackling this sort of as directly and as large scale as it has been up till now. Obama very much wants to be a domestic president, and the capture and kill, I fear, would draw us into ignoring Al-Qaeda, Inc. into other parts where it's growing stronger.
Daniel.
I'm not sure I would agree with that. I mean, I think what would happen, I agree with Nancy entirely, what would happen if Osama bin Laden was killed? It would be the most wonderful political windfall that President Obama could desperately think of.
Politically.
It's absolutely true that these days, every intelligence official you talk to says, we really don't think they could carry out a 9/11. Already they say we think they're on the back foot. They couldn't plan one of these spectaculars. They might get a guy with a backpack on a metro or a plane, but they can't do anything orchestrated like 9/11. I don't know whether that's true, but that's what they say. That kind of low-level threat, the kind of disaster that we saw in London in 2005 or that we saw in Spain a year or so before, that, I think, is going to be out there really in perpetuity.
And I'm not sure the people involved or their families regard it as low level. Moises.
I don't know how much of a practical consequence that question has, because I think that the government, the U.S. government, is obliged to go after the leaders of Al-Qaeda, is doing so at different levels and with different, you know, at different times with different levels of intensity. And you can rest assured that if they know where they are, they're going to go after them in any way possible.
And just to get to John's question directly, right now the trail is pretty cold from all indications that we have in terms of where bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are. At this point, they're depending. It's going to have to be someone coming forward when they feel safe doing so, and they know that.
To Cleveland, Ohio, Ahmed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Moses Naim, what does he think of somebody in the top government in Egypt who said that the Shiite in Iraq are more loyal to Iran than the Arabs?
That's a long-standing and difficult issue, and has to do with the expansive influence that Iran is having in the region, and specifically in Iraq. And that was part of the debate around the election. The election in Iraq was also hinging. Are you going to vote for the Iranians? Are you going to by voting for? For the Iraqi, you in fact are supporting and endorsing an expansive role of Iran in Iraq.
And, of course, now the UN Security Council may impose a fourth round of sanctions on Iran. Would the U.S. go it alone if UN sanctions fail?
I think the U.S. is going to get these UN sanctions. It is a bit like, to use that old cliche, it is watching like watching an elephant give birth. This, I mean, it was supposed to be swift consequences at the end of the year if Iran didn't talk. We're probably going to get a red sanctions resolution, I would guess, in June, for various reasons too complicated to go in with. The question is, and then what? Because many people have said, and I think Defense Secretary Gates hinted at this, a UN sanctions resolution isn't a strategy. When I spoke to Hillary Clinton a couple of weeks ago, she said, well, we kind of think that if we do have a sanctions resolution, then there may be a better chance that Iran is more willing to have good faith negotiations. That's hardly a ringing endorsement of the result. What we are seeing, I think, are two things. First of all, they're pushing for a sanctions resolution because that's what they can do. That's the lever they have to hand. Secondly, we are beginning to see things below the surface. It's a containment that cannot speak its name. They want to keep Iran in its box, but they don't want to say the word containment.
Moises.
It would not be a minor victory for the Obama administration to get Russia and China and other major powers to support sanctions against Iran. It may be that, as Daniel says, the day after looks more complicated, but the day before is a very celebratory day for the Obama administration. What I understand is that it's going to be not very debiting sanctions. They're going to have two levels, two tiers of sanctions, one that is going to go through the United Nations, and then they're going to have what they call optional set of sanctions that are far harder and that they're going to try to get other countries to support.
Moises Naim, he's editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email posted by Jackie. She says, how explosive is the situation in Britain? Is there an estimate on how many would-be voters would abstain because they're disgusted with all official political parties? The people oppose wars, the economy is in bad shape, and the new Labour Party doesn't represent workers anymore at all. Daniel.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. Actually, it looks like turnout will be quite high because it's going to be a close race. So people are disgusted, for all the reasons she said, and excited at the same time. I don't know if you can make a new word, disgust, cited, or something like that. That's certainly the feeling that people have. It's true, however, that this is an election that could really transform Britain. As Moises said, there are some huge policy decisions ahead, but we simply don't know whether we're going to have permanent coalition governments going ahead. We don't know whether the Labour Party, which is a party which won a huge majority in 1997 and again 2001, is headed for the political exit. We don't know whether the Liberal Party, which is a very old party, is going to get back to prime time. And people are excited by that.
Moises.
It is a very important election. It has, for example, the mere fact that you have the third party playing such a role is very transformative, and is already raising all sorts of issues concerning how do you organize, again, what I said before, the issue here is not winning the election, is governing after you won the election.
What about this fellow Clegg? Is he going to play any kind of role, Daniel?
Nick Clegg is someone quite a lot of us know quite well, and his meteoric rise has been truly astonishing. He's someone that many of us knew from his days in Brussels, and in one poll recently he was rated as popular as Winston Churchill, if not more so. It's clear that according to every single poll in the last few days, the Liberal Democrats would get, on the basis of those polls, second place. He may have a power of kingmaker, but there's also the prospect that he has a different kind of victory, a longer-term victory, which is if the Labour vote really collapses, David Cameron can basically walk into 10 Downing Street on his own. Nick Clegg would not be the kingmaker. He would not sit in cabinet, but he would have a prospect that no Liberal has had for almost 80 years of being Prime Minister one day. That would be a revolution for my country.
So it's going to be a very interesting election for all of us to watch. Thank you all so much, Daniel Dombey of Financial Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.